Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. I'm Rick Barton. I'm the co-director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project here at CSIS, and on behalf of the Middle East Institute, our co-host today, Wendy Chamberlain, the president, and the president of CSIS, John Hamry, my co-director, Karen Von Hippel, Stephen Flanagan, the head of our International Security Program. It's a great pleasure to have you all here today. I think it's going to be a very lively discussion of an important subject at exactly the right moment. So we're really very fortunate to have our guests today. I know that I look around the room, I know there are many people who have great expertise in this subject area. Marvin Weinbaum has joined us at the head table, and he will sort of serve as the bridge between the speakers and the question and answer period. We're hoping there will be a good hour discussion. Our guests have been on a global tour with this book. They are distinguished journalists who have done a remarkable job of research with this particular book. And I know that the people who have already contacted me who have specific questions and in some cases objections, and we're looking forward to that kind of a stimulating conversation. Adrian Levy and Catherine Scott Clark are our guests today. And the way we're going to work this is Adrian will present about a 25-minute or 30-minute presentation of the thesis, bring it into the events of today, and then Catherine will really be the primary respondent for the question and answer period. So they operate very much as a team, and we know that many of the issues that people want to raise have to do with what's going on today. The interest of CSIS is really, as you know from our recent report that came out, is in maturing the relationship with Pakistan in a way that we haven't really seen in the prior several decades. And part of that is naturally a greater transparency, which we think will enhance the democratic values of both countries at the same time. And this book certainly makes that core argument in a rather powerful way. So we're looking forward to the discussion. Thank you very much for being with us this morning. And Adrian, if you would take over, please.
Well, good morning, everyone. And what a week to be coming to DC with this. It's just keeping pace with the events. Every morning we're waking up to a whole scroll of new news and trying to put it into some kind of context. But I think a lot of what's happening now, which we're going to touch on at the end of the presentation, does actually relate to the central thesis of the book. And the nuclear program for Pakistan, very much within that, is a microcosm of the West and America in particular's roller coaster relationship with Pakistan. And part of what our book is about is to identify that stop-start relationship, which I've been describing very much as a feast and famine situation, where we are incredibly amorous and love Pakistan at times of security need. And of course, we are quite the opposite at times when Pakistan is no longer a bulwark for the US or the UK, for the European powers. And in that sense, that that feast and famine, that that roller coaster, that stop-start relationship, very much characterises, in my view, in our view, the evolution of the WMD program for Pakistan and our attitude towards it. I mean, quite clearly, prior to 1979, there was pretty much a consensus of opinion after India had detonated its bomb in 74, and it became an inevitability that there would be a arms race in South Asia. It became quite clear, and we know through documents released from Freedom of Information, that regardless of how the position would look, Pakistan was to be prevented at all costs from having a WMD program. There were even discussions that Brent Scowcroft was part of at physically interdicting that program, attacking it, destroying it in a kind of model for what would happen with Oz-Iraq. But come 79, the world changed. And a whole series of new factors present themselves, which, of course, would recharacterize our relationship with Pakistan and also very much with the nuclear program. These events are obvious in the sense that we have the fall of the Shah in Iran and the return of Khomeini. And, of course, we have the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, both of which place Pakistan, through geography and fact, as potentially a crucial bulwark for the US and the West. And, of course, that is identified very forcibly by Zbigniew Brzezinski, talking to Carter in December 79, who insists that Carter begins to readdress some of these checks and balances in order to re-embrace Pakistan. Pakistan at that time, of course, was very much following the hanging of Zulfiqar Ali Bhutto, Benazir's father, and the acceleration of its nuclear program, was very much an outsider. But come 79, in December 79, Zbigniew Brzezinski suggests that one of the gold standards of government, non-proliferation, for the first time be downgraded in order that Pakistan could be wooed afresh, and that a new relationship could be struck up, that Pakistan could be used as a springboard. Now, in a sense, those discussions go pretty much nowhere as the Carter administration runs out of steam, but they become particularly significant within days of Reagan coming to power. And we know, obviously, that within perhaps as little as a week or 10 days, there are conversations taking place on an ambassadorial level and also on the Secretary of State level, in this case between Al Haig and the number two in Pakistan, General K.M. Arif, in which the American position will be described quite clearly. And that position, as described by Al Haig, was that Reagan and the Reagan administration could very much live with a Pakistani bomb. That message would be one that would be conveyed by other emissaries for the administration. James Buckley would convey a similar message to Aga Shahi, the Foreign Secretary, and that message would also be conveyed by General Vern Waters, who was acting as an extraordinary ambassador for the White House. And in his form, as was recalled by others who knew him, it was very much remove the nuclear program from our radar, stop it cropping up so that it causes embarrassment to the Reagan administration. But what began, in essence, as turning a blind eye during a period, of course, when the Reagan administration was bound to certify year in, year out, regarding the Pakistan nuclear program to certify that Pakistan had no bomb, would develop into something far more permissive. But before I get to that permissiveness, as it's often described, what I'd quite like to touch on is the Pakistanis' own chronology of what was going on with the program. Chronology put together by K.M. Arif, the number two. And their perspective, which is backed up by other corroborating evidence sent by A.Q. Khan, the father of the program, and submissions made to the IAEA, places the simple chronology is this. By 1978, Pakistan had managed to enrich uranium to weapons grade. By 1982, there had been a series of cold tests of its bomb. Simulations, in effect. By 83, they were repeated, and Arif and others maintain that in 84, a hot test of the device did take place on behalf of Pakistan by the Chinese in Lop Nur. By 87, we know that the bomb, fully assembled, could be attached to an American-supplied F-16, which was the platform of choice. Now, at the same time, we have a collision of factors taking place. We have a open attitude towards Pakistan's WMD program, and we have elements within government that are still attempting to interdict it, and that would be an inevitable collision, in the sense that if one examines the Rich Barlow case, many of you will be familiar with his story, working on the Pakistan desk, having come from the ACDA, working on the Pakistan desk for the CIA. Barlow, I should add, who's not a pragmatist. Barlow, who's an idealist, Barlow, who actually believes that all data should be acted upon rather than actually a man who looks at his job as simply mining a miner of data that would then be passed for politicians to make policy out of. Barlow begins to put together a picture. And the picture that he begins to describe to his superiors is twofold. One, what concerns him is a process of licensing whereby Pentagon officials appear to be giving the green light or licensing dual-use technology that's been proscribed by other US departments to go towards Pakistan, technology that could only be used for their WMD program. That's the first stage of conflict, shall we say. The second stage, which worried him, was going through no distribution cables. There was a clear pattern of clientitis going on, in the sense that when there were US Customs Service operations and CIA operations looking to interdict the Pakistan purchasing program within the US. A lot of those operations were being compromised. They were being tipped off by presidential appointees who were sending, in the form of demarches, at the last minute, advice to the Pakistanis saying this operation is going ahead. And in two clear cases, those operations were compromised and the people who had been followed failed to turn up in the places they were meant to turn up. So Barlow put together a series of complaints on this, and these were forwarded and subsequently buried, and he felt in his own way cold-shouldered then by various people, including David Einsel, who was then the National Intelligence Officer for WMD, etc., out of the CIA. Foolishly, maybe, for someone who was not pragmatic, he would end up in the Pentagon working again as an analyst on the South Asian program. And during that time, he was asked to write an intelligence estimate on the state of play of the Pakistan program. This is in 1989, approximately. And the estimate that he would put together, which would go to Dick Cheney, then Secretary of State, and was meant to be presented to the NSC and then onwards, was very much about what we knew. And he put in that estimate a chronology, which is very much Arif's chronology, about the evolution of the Pakistan program. And he also gave his best advice, gathered also by the DIA, concerning the assembled Pakistan bomb and the fact that it could be deployed by an American-supplied F-16. Barlow found his security clearances evaporated pretty much overnight. He was subject to a classified investigation procedure, classified in the sense that no one was permitted to tell him who had made charges against him or even to describe the exact circumstances of the charges or their detail. Quite a Kafkaesque situation. Subsequently, he would be cleared in a triple Inspector General's inquiry, Inspector Generals for the State, for CIA and for Defence. And they would very much, or at least one of them, the lead IG, would very much identify the smear that had been deployed against him, an insinuation spread through the Pentagon that he was in some way working against US interests. He was not a patriot. His wife, who was also at the CIA, Cindy, was turned against him. And a cast of characters who surrounded this smear and the ousting of Barlow, I should add, are remarkably similar to some of the players who would turn up in the Wilson Plame affair many years later using a similar methodology. Barlow, through partial disclosure, found that his intelligence estimate had been rewritten. The estimate or report, the briefing, had been rewritten to say pretty much precisely the opposite of what he'd been saying regarding the Pakistan program, and there was no mention of the capability of deploying a device on an F-16, and this was critical because, unknowns to Barlow, the Pentagon was putting through a new program of sales of several billion dollars for F-16s to Pakistan, hence the motivation possibly for misrepresenting his report. But this comes now from the period of feast, in the sense that aid has been flowing quite liberally in Pakistan, aid that was needed to get through to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan into a period of famine. The period of famine would follow the movement into Bush Senior's administration, where the Soviets have now withdrawn from Afghanistan, and in essence, because Pakistan is not needed any longer as a security bulwark, there will be zero tolerance now of the nuclear program, the WMD program, that has been so aided and allowed so liberally to grow, permissively to grow, within the Reagan administrations. Now, we know that during this time, for whatever reasons they chose to do it, several key people within the Pakistan military chose to offer advice to American officials about what they would do next, what they would look to do next should aid be curtailed. One of those was General Mirza Aslam Beg, then the new Chief of Army Staff, who approached, among others, Bob Oakley and I think Norman Schwarzkopf. Was also approached, and Harry Roan, then working, Schwarzkopf, of course, CENTCOM commander, Harry Roan, then working in the Pentagon. And I think all three were delivered a fairly similar message, and that message was, you know, if money is stopped, Pakistan may well look to exploiting its nuclear hardware to make cash. And I think in the case of the meeting with Bob Oakley, General Beg had returned from Iran and was looking tremendously relieved at the meetings he'd had with the Revolutionary Guard in Iran. Now, those reports were all duly those meetings, the accounts of those meetings, were all duly submitted back to Washington. And whether or not they were taken seriously at the time, or they were characterised as hyperbole by a well-known chauvinistic gung-ho general, it's not clear. But what is clear, both from those sources and from the Khan inner circle, that starting from 87, a permissive, shall we say, relationship would develop between Pakistan and Iran, one which Khan and Khan's emissaries were instructed to ignite, that would take place in a building that they came to know as the Mummy and Me building, named after the children's store on the ground floor in Dubai, whereby emissaries for the Revolutionary Guard would come together and meet with Pakistan emissaries and discuss a potential trade in 87, something that wouldn't really move into full motion until the early 90s. But key to this as well, according to members of the Pakistan military and the Khan inner circle who we interviewed, was the changing thesis or philosophy within the Pakistan military. In 87, Zia had commissioned a new strategic look at where Pakistan should go. This based on the expectation that America would withdraw and famine would follow feast in terms of the relationship. A need to find more permanent allies, more reliable sources of funding other than Saudi cash that was coming in, and Chinese technical assistance, which was abundant and had been abundant since 1976, after Pakistan had actively and successfully campaigned to get communist China onto the UN Security Council, something which China would reward Pakistan with year in, year out, with technical assistance in the nuclear program. Zia's idea was to take Hamid Gul, then head of the ISI, and Mirza Aslam Beg, the chief of the army staff, well, vice chief in 87, before Zia's death, and commission them to kind of have a think through Pakistan's options. And they put together a document which has now become quite well discussed, a document which actually, in its rough form, a copy of which would be taken by Had, the Afghan intelligence, who would ship it back to Moscow. And bizarrely enough, when Matrochkin copied down all of the foreign archives in the Lubyanka for the KGB and brought them to London with Christopher Andrew, that original document, or a copy of it, would come back to London to Christopher Andrew to slot into the Matrochkin archive books, volume 1 and 2, which looked at the foreign policy of the FSB, amongst other issues. What the document spelt out was the need or the desire to create a security buffer, a partnership, whether that be counter-NATO or counter-US, which would take in Afghanistan in its north and Turkey in the south, creating a defensive dagger pointing towards India. Critical to this was to create a situation in Afghanistan where a conservative Pashtun government would be put in place, one that would be more loyal or subservient to Islamabad's goals. And the idea of the nuclear dimension was that Pakistan could act more brazenly in the knowledge that it had this nuclear umbrella, making it hard for its behaviour to be tempered or undermined. At the same time, part of that discussion with creating the strategic buffer was producing the weapons in public. Beg himself recalled a series of discussions where he said, we need to take the bomb out of the basement. And the purpose of weapons of mass destruction is that they invoke terror, and they only invoke terror when they can be seen rather than the knowledge or intimation that we have them. So this philosophy became central to the idea of marketing the cash cow of uranium technology that Pakistan had so cleverly and quickly perfected throughout the 80s until it was a usable technology. Then if we go through a rough chronology from what we know from the Khan circle, from the scientists themselves and from the military who are working with them in the 90s, there are a series of other crucial events that fit in with this building thesis with Pakistan. Key among them, of course, is the idea of defiance of the West, not only creating a security buffer for Pakistan. And one of those initial acts of defiance was in 1990, or the beginning of 91, as America and Europe became involved in forcing Saddam back from Kuwait, was an approach made by the Pakistan military or agents for them to sell a ready-made nuclear bomb to Saddam. Now, we know this through documentation recovered by weapons inspectors in 1995 in a farmhouse in Iraq from a relative of Saddam's. And that documentation, which Gary Dillon, one of the chief weapons inspectors, and others inspected and believed to be true, pointed to a series of meetings whereby the Pakistanis discussed what kind of weapon they could offer, how long it would take to build and ship, and they were entitled, just as a footnote, quite curiously, Project AB, which Dillon and others struggled for ages to work out what it could mean, until one of them decided it probably just stood for atom bomb. It was that simple. But so bizarre was the request, and perhaps so audacious, or perhaps so unimaginable in a sense, that Saddam, according to the documentation, turned the deal down. And as far as we know, that went nowhere. But immediately afterwards, the army maintains, as do the scientists, that relations with Iran, seamlessly switching from Iraq to Iran, would heat up. The Iranians, perplexed that the first series of technologies that they'd obtained from Pakistan, which was a basic P1, as it was known, the first series of centrifugal technology, P1 centrifuges, was inferior. In a sense, it was trash. It was the stuff that Pakistan had got rid of in order to develop and modify an extensive new range of centrifugal technology. They demanded the new and better technology, and those deals were signed up. And apparently, fissile material was part of that deal, highly enriched uranium being shipped out alongside the P2 technology. We know also that along that time there were other tentative discussions, but it's very impossible to verify where those discussions went. There was intelligence showing meetings, intelligence gains in Britain, America, and Israel showing meetings between Pakistani agents and the Syrians that took place in Lebanon. We know from reports made to the IAEA at the end of the 80s and the beginning of the 90s that the Saudis too made a direct approach, looking not to obtain the process, but to obtain a warhead for one of the Chinese missiles that they'd bought. Again, this was a request. The Saudis supplied money to the Pakistan program, but no one has a clear picture of what went on in terms of the deal pressing forward. Now, Benazir Bhutto claims that in 1993, in her way of looking at things, she became ensnared potentially in a North Korean deal. The PPP, her party, the Pakistan People's Party, had a long fraternal history with the North Koreans, something instigated by her father, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto. And she was approached one day in 1993 by AQ Khan, who said that Khan and the military would be only too glad if she would make a trip, a side trip, while she was on a mission to Beijing, pop into North Korea, sit down for a meeting, and perhaps suggest that, as part of a trade, Nodong missile technology would come back to Pakistan, something that the Pakistanis wanted to reverse engineer as part of their nuclear program. And she recounted this extraordinary dinner as she sat down and tried to work out what time it was polite to pop the question that Nodong missiles were needed. That brief hadn't come before the meeting. It would be a new course slipped into the multi-course banquet. She did, and came back in her handbag, as is now often reported, with blueprints for a Nodong missile, to be met off the plane by a phalanx of political advisors, one of whom immediately warned her that this would was in effect an entrapment by the military, in that her name would forever be attached to the North Korean deal. And that deal, certainly later on, according to the Khan scientists and the military surrounding them, would be payment for it would be made with crucial centrifugal technology, and also help in obtaining prescribed super hard alloys like miraging steel, completed rotors for centrifuges, and potentially even fissile material. Now, finally, the last ambitious deal, of course, was the Libyan deal, one which we're now quite familiar with. Saif Gaddafi, the son of Gaddafi, coming to London, concerned by the direction politics had taken with regime change, offering some kind of gambit, a remarkable deal, effectively, to give up the WMD program from Libya in exchange for Gaddafi not being decapitated, in essence. And we know from the wrapping up of that deal by MI6 and by the CIA that we were able to show, looking at the technology, its relationship to the original Urenco technology and blueprints that Khan had taken, and therefore the genus of that technology was very much Pakistani technology. Not only that, but a lot of side material that came from that deal actually explained the fabrication of it, the way it had been constructed, and the new genesis of the so-called Khan network, which had moved out for logistics to Dubai and had moved for manufacturing to Malaysia, where there were skilled technicians who also were working for companies that had the additional cover of being related to a former prime minister's family, giving them a kind of security clearance. And South Africa, of course, was another basis of operation where, having revoked its nuclear program, there's a pool of labor that needed work and was willing and able to work. We also know that at that stage, according to the Khan circle, his many, many trips to Africa, which have been recorded, served a specific purpose, because they were looking for warehousing facilities for a lot of their dual-use components, and Sudan in particular had been selected as a place to stockpile a lot of that technology. Now, that brings us to the here and now. In 2001, most of the intelligence that's coming in, both to Europe, to Britain, I shouldn't separate Britain from Europe, that's an old habit, from Europe from Europe, and from the US, clearly points to a very detailed picture of Pakistan. I think it would be fair to say that post-2011, we could articulate and describe a picture of a military regime that suppressed human rights, that was indirectly linked to 9/11 and directly linked to Al Qaeda and the Taliban, and that had been proliferating WMD technology, possibly on a larger scale known to any of us. And of course, that was not Iraq; that was Pakistan. But the new relationship, we're going to go through a period of feast now, would dictate the indemnifying of Pakistan, in essence, and Pakistan would be indemnified in order to become our very necessary client in the war on terror post-2011. But that process of indemnification, whereby as bits of the story of Pakistan's proliferation began to slip out, mostly through an Iranian dissident group that by chance got hold of information on the Natanz enrichment program, it became necessary to focus the story very much on AQ Khan. And so rather than the Pakistan military and their involvement in proliferation being the story that was told, AQ Khan very much took the rap, along with a small group of scientists, as rogue players in some kind of piecemeal operation, a one-stop nuclear shop, the indemnification of the military, the falling of his sword by Khan. That brings us to what we got from such a deal, or why we would even make such a deal. The clear terms of it were this: that Pakistan was a crucial partner in the war on terror, that it would favourably, with energy, take part in the de-radicalisation of its own society, giving us access to crucial border areas, sharing intelligence, aiding us or working with us on military operations, and not only that, but proscribing Sunni chauvinist groups that were of particular danger at the time, and of course wrapping up the proliferation network. If we zoom to 2006, November, December, and to January 2007, two new remarkable reports come into the open that are very explicit. One from Dame Eliza Manningham Buller, then of MI6, and one from Bruce Riedel, who'd served twice as a director in the NSC under Clinton and Bush. And those reports point to something specific, which is the Pakistanization of Taliban and Al-Qaeda, that in fact the reverse process has happened since 2001, that what had been effectively a spent force in terms of Al-Qaeda had moved into south and north Waziristan and the border areas and had become resurgent. The same was true for the Taliban, and a series of perplexing peace agreements that had been made by Musharraf in the north and south of Waziristan, which he put down to operational necessity in 95, 2005 and 2006, had direct consequences. We were in Helmand province on the other side, and NATO commanders could chart pretty much 160, 165% increase in cross-border attacks that were taking place as a result of those moves. De-radicalisation seemed to be too hard a project for Musharraf too. It never happened. The number of madrasas, unregulated continue to spawn. There are no accurate figures, in fact, even in the numbers. ICG put out a report of International Crisis Group, Samina Ahmed, claiming that there may be 13,000 still, many of them linked to proscribed organisations. But it isn't just the de-radicalisation, the proscribed groups themselves, which Pakistan military often describe as freedom fighters, because they had been given succour and trained to ignite the battle in Kashmir. Those groups, proscribed in 2001, December, by Pakistan and the US State Department, came out again under new names and guises after the devastating earthquake of 2005, and are living and working quite openly in Muzaffarabad, in the Pakistan-administered area of Kashmir. But not only that, they, according to Riedel and his report in January 2007, mated very effectively with the remnants of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, providing more bodies on the ground for organisations that previously until then were dying. So we have a situation whereby de-radicalisation never took place, where radicalisation and the manipulation of the jihadi faction, which is an old favoured strategy of the Pakistan military, continued apace. And then if we return finally, to stop this at this point, to the AQ Khan imbroglio, what did we get from that element of the deal? Khan was held under house arrest. His so-called network was purportedly wrapped up. But there never was any access given to Khan or the scientists. And if there was, what would he say? That he was doing the bidding of the Pakistan military, that he was working as part of the foreign policy of Pakistan? Well, all we know is that 2006, Musharraf announced that the investigation was closed, there would be no further action, and that would be the last statement made on proliferation. At the same time, the BND and other intelligence agencies in Europe put out a report that would wend its way to the IAEA saying something completely different, that two factors had emerged. One, Pakistan was still buying, purchasing in Europe and attempting to purchase in North America far more than it could need in terms of dual-use components, leading to one suggested conclusion that this was buying to sell. A suggestion, no more than that. Two, the Justice Department had been working on a series of investigations, one of which was connected to a company called Pakland, a company that Barlow, going right back to 1987 and 88, had identified as a shutout company used by the Pakistan military. It was up and working again in 2004 and 2005, purchasing triggers for the Pakistan program through a South African shutout company contacting American suppliers. There was more. An audit would surface from Kahuta, the labs, the Khan research labs, that showed that there had been not only inadequate but dismal attempts to keep account of the fissile material being produced from the Khan research labs, and that one speculation was that as many as 40 drums of HEU could not be accounted for. Whether that had gone partly to the Iranian program or perhaps to North Korea, it's not clear. But what there was a question mark as to where the material had gone. So I guess this takes us to the here and now and the chaos which we're watching now. And one of the questions to throw open, and perhaps we can pick up on it, is what we got from that relationship 7 years down the line and whether it bred security or greater insecurity. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Marvin, why don't you start us off, and then Catherine will turn to you. And when we move to the question and answers, please identify yourself by name and affiliation at the beginning of your question. And if you could also keep your questions and comments to a tolerable length, and if I find it to be going on, I'll let you know.
Thank you, Rick. I want to applaud what you've been able to do. It's long in coming. I think there will be others who will be exploring some of the same terrain, but this undoubtedly is one of the most complete accounts of this 20-year period or so. Just a few remarks here. I had an opportunity to see some of this unfolding late in the 90s and early 2000, when I was in the State Department of Intelligence and Research. And by the way, with Benazir Bhutto and her trip, she claims that, as far as she was concerned, this was a cash deal.
Yeah.
Yes. And that there was no nuclear aspect to it whatsoever. And she still maintains that position.
She's a little bit less certain about it now. She says, okay, maybe 10 years on, 15 years on, I'm not so sure, but that was what I was told at the time.
Right. And, of course, that's just the way it happened. She was told. She was also informed regularly that she wasn't to ask too many questions, but she would be told what she needed to know. What always struck me as very strange during this period, the same period I'm talking about, was watching A.Q. Khan making his trips to Africa, and of course his palace in Timbuktu, watching him spend freely traveling to Saudi Arabia in particular. And I remember constantly saying to myself, you don't do this on a government salary. Obviously, he was accumulating a great deal of wealth, it seemed to me. But what was even stranger for me is that there were no red flags that were going up at the time. And in fact, as you've pointed out, it doesn't really, the whistle isn't finally blown until Libya, Iran, make it impossible to keep this under wraps any longer. And I, for one, was always looking for what the motivation was for this. Certainly after 9/11, one could say this was partnership in the war on terror. But I have trouble understanding what the motivation was before 9/11. And I didn't want to come to the conclusion that somehow we were complicit in this, because I saw no particular motivation on U.S. part to do so at that point. We, of course, as you point out, up until 9/11, our military-to-military relationship with Pakistan had ended, actually, in 1990. And that's always remained with me as a bit of a dilemma, a confusion. With respect to A.Q. Khan, my understanding is there may have been some initial opportunity to get to him, but it was shut off very quickly. And I think the only conclusion one can come to with A.Q. Khan, and I think many people share the view that, of course, in a way he's the fall guy, although one shouldn't underestimate his role in this as well. But the only explanation here was that, because, you know, it was a rather brazen statement on the part of the Pakistan government to simply say, no, at that point, you can't have any access to this man, given all of the priority that we've been giving, at one end of Washington, at least, to non-proliferation, that he was unavailable. Oh, yes, if you'll submit to us some questions, we'll entertain those and impose those, and we'll tell you what he said. But that was it. I think the general feeling was that that his ability here to say, look, if you expose me to this kind of interrogation, you know what I'm liable to say. And I think there's pretty good there were exchanges going on with North Korea as late as 2003 for missiles. And these were being carried in Pakistani military aircraft. Somehow, the idea that they would simply allocate them to the Khan research labs and have no accounting of what was going on was just beyond credibility. So it is very clear then that the Pakistan military was more than simply apprised of it, but was actually a party to much of what was going on. Again, I think that this is I'm looking forward to reading the book. I would have read it anyway, but I think initial comments here certainly have enticed us all, I suspect, to read it. So why don't we go into questions?
All right. Thanks very much. Catherine, if you'd like to take the podium. I know that there are a number of questions. There are also some seats here. If you want to quickly, there are three seats in the front row that, unless you prefer standing, please come on over before Catherine gets warmed up. Catherine, you may want to just address a couple of those comments, or do you want to go straight to the questions?
Comments from Marvin.
Yes.
Yeah. Just one thing I'd like to say, responding to what Marvin was saying. One thing that made the involvement of the Pakistan military very clear to us was when we got a very detailed account of how materials came in and out of Kahuta from the son of A.Q. Khan's constant companion and aide-de-camp, who's Brigadier Sajewel, who was under house arrest in 2004, soon after A.Q. Khan went onto television and confessed to his singular activities. But Sajewel's son explained to us that nothing ever went in and out of Kahuta without constant ISI and military noting. I mean, his father had to make copious requests for official permissions to move materials and reports of what was coming in on lorries and cars and whatever, where it was going to, whether it was going to the military airport at Chaklala, whether it was going onto a civilian plane. So the suggestion that things could be ferried in and out in the middle of the night to Libya without anyone in an official capacity knowing about it, it was an impossible scenario. Also, one point that Musharraf has said himself in response to the military not being involved at all, and this is something that's backed up by Feroz Khan, who's spoken a lot in America, that this was a one-man operation and the Pakistan military knew nothing about it, is that they have both pointed out that Khan was put under increasing pressure and limited in his travel from 1999 onwards. As soon as Musharraf came in, he was told that there was a problem with A.Q. Khan, and he was proliferating and he had to be kind of stopped. So the ISI was given extended responsibility to watch his travel, and he was expected to explain where he was going, who he was visiting. I know that initially he rebuffed these requests and just carried on travelling anyway. But the suggestion he could be going to, for example, Saudi Arabia, where he flew 40 times in the last few years of his operation, without anyone knowing about it, is ridiculous. I mean, he was tracked at every stage, and all of his movements were monitored. And the other point that's made by Musharraf or by Feroz Khan is that A.Q. Khan was effectively retired in 2001. In March 2001, he was officially retired, and there was a big dinner in Islamabad, and Musharraf spoke at the dinner and described him as my hero, and how he had obviously brought Pakistan into the nuclear fold, which was a great achievement, which I don't think anyone would criticise inside Pakistan. But if you look at some of the proliferation activities of the so-called Khan network, they continued much beyond that point. At a stage where Khan was supposedly retired, having no access to the official labs, being constantly followed by the ISI, not being able to ring up to ask for a plane from the PIA or the Pakistan Air Force or Shaheen Transport, which was another military-run private company that was used to ship materials, particularly to North Korea. All of those activities continued, and the Libyan operation, the program to give the completed centrifuge plant to Libya, was only shut down in mid-production at the end of 2003, 2 years after Khan had retired. We also spoke to at length to Peter Griffin, who had supplied Khan and Pakistan since the mid-70s onwards, and he said that he was always paid right up until till 2004, when his company ceased to work on the Libyan program. He was always paid by the Pakistan military. So I think there are numerous pointers that this is not a one-man band, and that attempts to present it as such we should not believe. And if it was a one-man band, as Marvin has just said, why is the access not given to Khan now? Why have the questions that were supposed to have been posed through the ISI, through the Pakistani authorities to Khan, why were those questions never asked, and why were the answers never given back to Washington?
Can I just add one thing? Even when after he was retired and we thought that this So even after he retired and we thought this was his the conclusion of his involvement, he was then appointed as the advisor to Musharraf. He was restored, really, to the grace here. And the idea that somehow he was a figure to be shunned in any way was clearly not the case.
Well, we have 45 minutes, so please, why don't you just call people out, Catherine, if you could, and just...
Okay, first hand up.
Larry Robinson, formerly political counselor in Islamabad during the time of the takedown of AQ Khan, before that, State Department South Asia Bureau. Having worked on this subject now off and on for six, seven years, I look forward to reading your book. And I certainly agree that you can make a compelling narrative very much along the lines that you have done, because there are enough holes in the evidentiary material that you have to do a good bit of interpreting. You can also make a narrative that I find equally compelling that tracks with what Feroz Khan and Musharraf and General Kidwai have been saying. When I was in Islamabad at the height of this furor, what I was telling U.S. journalists all the time was, please keep an open mind. Don't simply accept the narrative that you're given. Look to see what you can actually find out. I'd like to make just a couple of quick comments on here. I certainly have not been under the impression that U.S. questions for Khan were not asked and that answers were not brought back. That's certainly not the impression that I had. Second, with regard to access for the U.S., I don't remember the U.S. granting Britain access to the Rosenbergs. I don't remember any country that has had a nuclear spy working for somebody else ever granting access to any third country. I think Marvin's got it exactly right that had Khan been provided to the Americans, the first thing he's going to do is say that he had full authorization all the way, whether or not that was true. The second thing he's going to say is spill the beans on Pakistan's covert import program, which very definitely existed, which Khan was a central part of, and which exists to this day for the very good reason that even if they didn't have any nuclear weapons at all, we won't let Pakistan import even essential safety equipment for their safeguarded nuclear power plants. They've got to have a covert import program. Khan was rich, absolutely. Everybody in Islamabad knew it. But everybody in Islamabad figured that he was getting rich the way everybody else in Islamabad officialdom does, by creaming off a percentage of all the import stuff. Since it was a covert program, the opportunities to do that are enormous. So I just urge everyone to keep somewhat of an open mind and not simply go for a single narrative when there are two narratives available that fit the relatively few known facts. Thanks.
Thank you. No, I mean, I agree with a lot of what you're saying, but I think the difference with Rosenbergs is that Musharraf did promise, my understanding is Musharraf did promise access to Khan.
Not that I recall.
Through.
He was interviewed, he was interrogated at great length by two generals, Sanal Haq, the head of ISI, and Khalid Kidwai, the head of the nuclear program. And they spent many, many hours with him, and told me and told many others that the man was one of the most accomplished liars they had ever seen in their life, and that it was impossible to get him to admit to anything unless presented with incontrovertible evidence, at which point he completely switched his story and became equally convincing in the new story.
And did he not also ask if he was going to be questioned that other people from the military authorities should be present as well?
That I do not know. That I don't know. Certainly, obviously, we would have liked to have access to him, but I have absolutely no doubt that what the Pakistanis predicted he would say was what he would tell us, that he would come up with a series of new stories and stick with each of them until it was proven incontrovertibly, until he knew that we knew otherwise.
But do you think that the U.S. administration today is satisfied with the outcome of the so-called Khan affair, that no one has been convicted, that some scientists are still under house arrest, but the investigation is now shut down? There is no future access. I mean, why is it that no one can really answer what exactly Pakistan supplied to North Korea or how far the negotiations went with Saudi Arabia or with Syria at a time when there's a lot of warmongering about Iran. Surely there are people in Islamabad who could help actually get to the bottom of what Iran actually has.
Possibly. I honestly don't know. And again, I've looked at this very closely from the inside. I don't know how many people really knew how much. I do know that, or I would suggest as a parallel, that I don't think Hyman Rickover's briefcase was ever examined carefully when he left the Navy nuclear programs. Rickover could have done everything that A.Q. Khan did. He had exactly the same type of authority. He was in charge of his own security. He was his own boss because he was head of the Navy program for the Atomic Energy Commission and the nuclear program for the Navy. He approved his own budgets. That's almost exactly parallel to the authority that A.Q. Khan had at Kahuta.
This is an absolutely terrific dialogue, but I know that there are other people here who...
I know that, too. I was answering questions.
It's exactly what I think we'd like to see, and I'm sure that the writers as well will learn, as we all do as we go along. There are lots of hands here, and I know that Bob Oakley... it might be good to give you a shot, Bob, since you've been singled out here.
One factual comment. Hamid Gul became head of ISI only after Zia died. And at that point only did his influence and his wacky ideas begin to grow. Up until that time, Zia and General Rahman had the nuclear program pretty much under control. Second, a comment about intelligence. The book seems to assume that U.S. intelligence, particularly on WMDs, is omniscient and infallible. I think we've seen time and time again, not just in Iraq, that this is wrong. And there were genuine differences of view within the intelligence community about what Pakistan had, how fast it was going. For some reason, they did not follow up the conversations with Begg. But I think that genuinely there was much less, the intelligence community did not think that Pakistan was as far along as you all think it was. And that was a genuine belief. They may have ignored Barlow, but I think it's important to recognize that there are lots of intelligence problems out there, and Pakistan was one. We knew more about what was coming in than we did about what was going out.
No, I just my understanding is that before Pakistan started sending out, i.e. in the 80s when the Afghan war was still going on, that there was enough intelligence coming into Washington to actually have a plan of Kahuta and even a blueprint of the Pakistani weapon, which I understand was shown to Sahibzade Yaqub Khan, is that right? To the foreign minister when he came over in, I think, 1989. So I understand what you're saying, that there is stovepiping going on and not every department necessarily knows what every other department knows. But I think that the level of knowledge about the Pakistan program by the end of the 80s was extremely high, and yet it wasn't until the cutoff imposed by Bush in senior in 1990 that really any kind of negative comments were made from Washington about what Pakistan had been up to. Yes.
I have a call, so I'm not... I don't know anything about intelligence other than what I read and what I hear, so forgive me for my naivete. You know, I'm reading this book, Sharpening Strategic Intelligence, Why the CIA Gets It Wrong, written by Richard Russell. I think that one of the things that in a lot of the forums, public forums about intelligence issues is that there seems to be a problem in the way we collect it, maybe not so much in problems in the way we collect it, but not even stove piping, it's that what emerges, the sort of memes that emerge after people talk about these things strike me as kind of stillborn. You know, and then afterwards, you know, there's a hiatus of about a couple of months and, you know, some aspect. And I'm wondering if there's any way that, you know, like your book, you know, whether there can be like a, you know, two-day discussion, you know, about it where people can have the full freedom to ask questions. That sort of thing, you know, may happen in, you know, very in secret, and then thus it's considered classified. But I think that if you're talking about transparency and you're wanting civil societies and different societies to, you know, sort of emerge as healthy societies, then a little bit more of that has to go on. It sort of goes in the opposite direction. So
I think that's a really good point, but I think there's a secondary point as well, which is one that we're trying to get to grips with now, which is the politicization of intelligence, and
yes,
which is very much
well,
a post 9/11
right,
situation.
True.
And you know, I'd like to just make two points: read the politicization
and ethnicize.
That's a difficult word to say. I'm glad you said it. That's okay. Absolutely right. And
yes.
I think and the hierarchy then of intelligence based on that. One related, the clear example, obviously related to Barlow with the physical rewriting and destruction of intelligence that was contrary to the goals of the Pentagon at the time. But also, if you look at the experience of people like Gordon Ehler under the Clinton administration, he went through a pretty similar situation. Gordon Ehler became National Intelligence Officer for WMDs and found himself in a difficult position vis-a-vis China. He had been supplying huge amounts of data about the Chinese missile program with Pakistan. They even had overheads at one stage showing the missiles in Sargodha Airport in their packing cases. And yet at no stage would Clinton consider sanctions, obviously because WTO and other pressing, very pressing foreign policy issues were coming to the fore, which meant that Indian voices, Israeli voices, European voices concerning the Pakistan-Chinese relationship and the nuclear program and the intelligence relating to that, the voices were ignored and the intelligence was reconstructed. Ignored by the White House and portrayed as the actions ultimately of individual companies rather than a nation state. And that would lead to perhaps Ehler's early retirement. So I think there are other key episodes through other successive administrations. And, of course, we all are much more familiar about the here and now and Douglas Feith and post 9/11 and the idea of cherry-picking intelligence.
Good exchange, but this we got.
Did you move on? I'm sorry. I'll shut up.
Good point. I think you made a good start. Sorry, you won't be able to put the period on every idea.
Thank you. I'm Shujaa Nawaz. I just want to say that after your presentation, I do look forward to reading the book. I have it, but the events of the last week or so have made it impossible to read it. I did dip into it, and I do have questions about the accuracy of two or three points, and I want to bring them to your attention. One, you make a rather startling claim about Musharraf linking up with Osama bin Laden and bringing Al-Qaeda to sort out the Shia in Gilgit. It's in the book. It's in
Sipa al-Sahaba.
But Osama bin Laden is mentioned in the same section.
It's Sipa al-Sahaba who his connection was with, the Sunni.
Yes, except that if you check against Musharraf's own book, and we hope that's accurate in terms of its chronology, he was at that time a brigadier in Karia in the Punjab, and not posted anywhere in the northern areas. Another point, you've taken as gospel Hamid Gul's narrative, and I think that's something which you may need to rethink, because you say that, you quote Hamid Gul as saying that Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif and the Americans prevented him from becoming the next Chief of Army Staff, and that Nawaz Sharif removed him from the army, which is totally inaccurate. He was removed by the army chief, and not by Nawaz Sharif, and Nawaz Sharif, in fact, supported him for the post of army chief. The third is you have Musharraf fighting in Siachen, and I think that's partly because he has a rather ambiguous telling of that story. He was then the deputy of the in the Directorate for Military Operations, and he says that he had a seat by from where he could see how policy evolved. And he describes the Siachen operation using "we," meaning Pakistan, not involving himself. So he was physically not involved in any of the fighting. I'm just concerned that, you know, picking up a lot of information from the web, including the famous Mr. Rahman, who has fantastic stories on the web, that, you know, you could be accused of hoovering and not sifting through. And I think that's the danger that we all face when we start collecting so much information and trying to make sense of it. Just wanted to share that with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments. I'll pass that over to Kathy. But I mean, one thing to bear in mind is that virtually none of our research is net-based, and it's been based on hundreds of face-to-face interviews, you know, more than a decade's worth of reporting. If there are inaccuracies in there, you know, thank you for sharing them with us, and we'll be glad to correct them for the paperback edition. But the hoovering exercise is a much more complex one involving repeat interviews, and our methodology normally is to repeatedly interview people until they can no longer bear to see us again.
but also we did check a lot of the military record material from Musharraf through the President of Pakistan website. So, I mean, I would like to go back and look at that again, but I mean, we didn't purely take it from in the line of fire or from sources in India. We checked it with many, many sources aside, but we will look at those areas again. Yes, sir, at the back.
Good morning. Henry Ziegler from... I'm associate editor of the Zegram. And first of all, thank you for your research and your exposure of this very important issue. If you wouldn't mind, I'd like you to take you to today, November the 9th, and we'll say that there's just been a coup in the United States and you've become president of the United States, which I know one woman would probably be very upset about. But in any case, what would you do relative to the current situation in Pakistan immediately, and what do you think is going to happen, let's say, over the next 30, 60, 90 days?
I think I'd immediately get on the phone to Musharraf and ask how long Benazir Bhutto is going to be held under house arrest in Islamabad. I'd ask for some kind of reassurance that this state of emergency, or martial law, however you want to term it, is... really going to be over in a matter of days rather than 30 days. I'd ask for more assurances that the elections are going to be held on February the 15th, which I think is the latest date that has been given. And most importantly, if I am the person with the purse strings, having given $10 billion already since 9/11 to Musharraf, I would be demanding much more accountancy for where that money is being spent and how the US war on terror, the West's war on terror, is actually benefiting from the cash that is being poured into Islamabad. I'd like to see transparency that money is not going into the Musharraf, keep Musharraf in power, slush fund, whether that is by having religious parties support him or whether that is by causing trouble on the border with the radical groups, which also aids Musharraf because he wants to weaken Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan and put in a Pashtun government. I'd like to see that money is being spent for the benefit of the West and also for the benefit of the Pakistani people, because one of the founding commitments of the deal with Bush in 2001 was to reintroduce democracy to Pakistan. And although we hear a lot about asking Musharraf to get back to the path of democracy now, this week and last week, I think there's very little evidence. I think less than 10% of the funding that's come from Washington in the last 6 years has been spent on any kind of humanitarian relief, whether it's school building, hospital building, creating proper parliamentary polls, proper kind of licensing of polling booths and census reports. I mean, that's not happening, so that's what I immediately would be asking. And the second part of your question was what's going to happen.
What is going to happen? And I mean, so you've got these assurances and nothing changes. Then what do you do?
Cuts off aid. Not overnight, but have a process whereby we look at the alternatives to backing a military government. We look at an alternative where we want to engage. We talk to the democratic parties in Pakistan, which have been enfeebled over the last 10 years, And we look at seeking assurances that at some stage there will be a free and fair election. The Democratic parties will be able to field their candidates openly rather than living in fear as they do today. I mean, I understand that, the PPP and the PMLN have both had hundreds of party workers imprisoned in the last few days. So although we are moving towards, theoretically, a position in February where we have a free general election, the first free general election in Pakistan for the last 10 years, it's already appearing that it's going to be a show, and the outcome is already predetermined. Who's been waiting the longest? Yes, you've been waiting at the back, sorry. Yep.
Yeah, my name's Simon Henderson. You said that Peter Griffin said that he was always paid with a check from the Pakistan military. Did that include the work he was doing on the Libyan project post-2001, i.e. After Khan had nominally resigned? And secondly, in my dealings with Griffin, he was never prepared to give me anything other than a conversation without money. What was your experience with him?
We don't earn enough to pay him a penny, and we wouldn't pay him any money for information. Yes, he did say that after 2001 he was still getting money from the... which bank was it? Can you remember which bank? His payments were coming from one of the Pakistan banks, and his understanding was that it was official money. It was not coming out of private bank, Habibi Bank, not coming out of money from Khan's private bank accounts. I mean, I would say, obviously, we do not believe everything that Peter Griffin says, and a lot of what he says is not is lies. He is determined to clear his name, and he's given us a lot of documentation about the role of his company, GTI, in the Libyan programme. And I don't have any reason to disbelieve the documentation that he's given us, because we've checked it through the authorities in Dubai, the Import Export Customs Authorities in Dubai, who say that those documents are genuine. Yes, sir.
My name is Vijay Nilekani, and first of all, I want to congratulate you on a very hard-hitting, honest kind of book. I haven't read it yet, but from the comments, that's the perception I get. But my question is, I can understand elected politicians and diplomats even making all kinds of compromises, including ugly compromises, or putting a spin on things. But the American media has given it a free pass all this while. That, to me, is amazing. Because, for example, last weekend when Musharraf declared the martial law, he released 24 Taliban on the same day that he said he was doing it for extremists, and American media has hardly reported on it. There was an op-ed piece in the New York Times, and that's about it. So I'm just amazed that the media just gives it a free pass. I can understand diplomats and politicians.
I share that amazement. I think that's something you have to ask the American media about. I think we can't underestimate the patriotism here. Move on.
Yes, sir. Thank you. My name is Rana Fawad. I'm a freelance journalist from Pakistan and blog for my page. So my question to you, Mr. Adrian, don't you think that you are reinforcing a very dangerous trend that certain countries have the right to police and have those nuclear weapons, and other countries and a media spin too, that when these weapons are possessed by others, they become WMD program? And second, that those countries cannot lie, but countries with power, they can lie. I'm referring to Dodgy Dossier and the Colin Powell's presentation in the UN.
Can I just say one thing just off the cuff? The reason we call this book Deception is mainly to reflect the deception on behalf of the American government in terms of its dealings with Pakistan.
I'm talking about the overall trend you're setting, that this is the main political picture, but you are painting the other things as lesser evil, which could be acceptable or something. My point is, who should police these things?
Well, broadly, we have a system whereby we presume that non-proliferation was supposedly a gold standard. And of course, there were exceptions to that in the way that Israel acquired its program, which perhaps is the subject of another book, maybe our next one. In fact, now that I've said that, maybe we should be commitment to doing the next book on Israel to balance this conversation out. And in every discussion, that does come up. But if we look at the issue of and the difficulties confronted by governments when faced by something like a gold standard of non-proliferation, it is an enormously difficult question. I understand the motivation for the Pakistan program. India began the arms race in 1974. Pakistan was reacting in a defensive position. That is commented on through all the traffic at the time. And there are decisions made as to how. You know, who the West would like. You're right, it is a policing system, and the IAEA is meant to be the method of enforcing that. I suppose the only thing I can comment on, apart from my general feelings, understandings of where you're coming from that comment, there is a double standard involved, is that what has significantly interested us is whether or not these decisions made to trade and barter with non-proliferation have ultimately made the world safer. That is basically one of the gists of the deception that we're examining. Did we win? Did we win by those decisions or not?
Yes, sir.
My name is Nishkam Agarwal. I'm a freelancer right now. I was very impressed by your descriptive analysis, but in terms of the motivation for why Pakistan is doing all these things, if we go back to 1974, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto is reputed to have said, Pakistan is going to eat grass in order to make the nuclear bomb. The question really that I'm trying to get at is that a lot of the things that Pakistan is doing possibly are because they're facing east, not facing west. And a lot of the analysis that takes place in this country is because we look at it from the perspective of Pakistan facing towards Israel and towards Western countries. That's not exactly the case. The truth is that Pakistan is 99%, if not 100%, focused on India. Yeah. And absolutely. It's really about Kashmir. Yeah. It's about the Harkatul Mujahideen and Lashkar-e-Taiba. The mic cannot take what I'm saying. But the point I'm trying to make is look east, not west, to analyze what they're doing.
But I totally agree with what you're saying, and I think part of the problem with American foreign policy with regard to Pakistan is that they do presume that Pakistan is looking west to the war on terror and aiding the West, when exactly you're right, the primary enemy has and always will be India. And I think a lot of it goes back to the war of 1971 in East Pakistan, when the Indian Army, with the help of the secessionist movement in East Pakistan, was able to halve Pakistan's territory in under 16 days. And the Pakistan Army, of which people like Musharraf were already officers, was made to look absolutely enfeebled. And I think, very much so, Musharraf personally has wanted to right that wrong in Kashmir. At several times in his military history, I think one time we would describe. Benazir Bhutto was saying in 1995, when she was second time Prime Minister and he was Director General of Military Operations, that he was trying to push ramping up the insurgency in Kashmir by using out of work jihadis from Afghanistan, something that she gave him very limited access to a plan to put into action, but something he obviously came back to with Kargil in 1999. So, yes, I agree with what you're saying. We misunderstand our ally in Islamabad. Yes, sir.
Yeah, from Visa with the Jerusalem Report. I have a question about Pakistani North Korean relations. North Korea received in the end 90s to the early 2000s enriched uranium. Jack Pritchett suspects that the North Koreans had in mind that a cash transaction, but instead the Pakistanis offered them the enriched uranium, and then they said, okay, do you have any information about this subject, whether what the intent was and how it worked out?
Yeah, I mean, we, the information that we have on this doesn't highlight that at all. I mean, the information that we have, picking up on comments that you made earlier, was that an inability to pay for hard technology led to the nuclear transfer, rather than that being an intention from the beginning, i.e. on behalf of Pakistan. Pakistan's inability to pay its current foreign exchange crunch led them down that path of paying through technology. And our understanding from some of those involved in the outer perimeters of that deal was that it was fissile material as well as miraging steel and components from centrifuges that were transferred through the late 90s, but no more than that.
Because they had no money to pay.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
My name is Dr. Podiel, National Advisory Council, South Asian Affairs. It seems that the focus on your book is that United States has a power over Pakistan to have Pakistan do what it is the intention of the United States. If that is true, I disagree.
Yeah, we did say.
Okay. Now, if we agree on this issue, then after the whole analysis you have made, what is a single advice that you would like to give us here in the United States that we do so that something that happened in Pakistan against what we did not desire will not happen again?
I'd look at the role of China in Pakistan. I think one of the key ignored power players in this is China and China's relationship. And it's if you just talk to people who have been a party to the establishment of that relationship and understand how beneficial it's been to China, you realise immediately what an extraordinary ally China has been, giving for nothing. There are very often everyone says, you know, there are no payments made in exchange for unlimited political support, technical assistance on the ground, weaponry exchanges, etc. And, you know, very much China could prove to be a broker in relation to Pakistan in the same way that it proved to be quite successful with North Korea, bringing North Korea back to talks. So I think there's an underestimation and perhaps even a failure to really calibrate the relationship between China and Pakistan. That's my first point. Secondly, there's a willful ignoring of the philosophy of the Pakistan military. I just think it's willful. I think that there's a misreading of the intentions, philosophy and strategy. A lot of it's patronising. Some of it is a kind of failure to really engage in the ideas of the Pakistan military and the intelligence establishment. Quite often the readings that you read in it are provincial and parochial. It's like people are not actually going to Pakistan and asking difficult questions. You know, the part of Kashmir and the role of it, the significance of it is sometimes underplayed. But also, why is the equation that's being put out at the moment, most pejoratively, from the Pentagon, that it's Musharraf or the Islamists? Why is that the equation? I would reconfigure this now in this room and say it's Musharraf and the Islamists. This is the equation I want us all to think about. And the reason being that, you know, if you just look at people like Hussein Haqqani's book on Between the Mosque and the Madrasa, but it's quite a good chronology. You know, we know, just very, very briefly, I won't hog the mic here, but 1988, you know, 1987, facing new elections with in 88 with Bhutto coming in. What does the ISI and the military do? They form a coalition of Islamists to beat down progressive forces. 1990, they form a slush fund. The slush fund is directed at Islamist forces. You know, the same pattern would go on, the manipulation of the Islamist faction. Who is Musharraf's? Who's Musharraf's electoral allies? The MMA. Who are the MMA? People who never had electoral success, Islamist forces. And, you know, this is a political tool, first for social control, then for political control. It explains a lot of what's been happening in Waziristan as well, with the to-ing and fro-ing. Let's have a correct analysis of what Pakistan needs to feel secure, you know, rather than guessing, throwing bombs at them and misunderstanding the strategy and philosophy.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
David Eisenberg, British American Security Information Council. For years now, the attitude of the Pakistani government toward Dr. Khan has been, to paraphrase Claude Rains and Rick's Cafe, that they're shocked that he was doing this sort of thing, and then went on with business as usual. But the fact of the matter is, as the whole world knows, you know, Pakistan has its nuclear weapons program. and it's going to need continuing things to keep it going, which it's not prepared to do on its own, so it needs to get it from the outside, which picks up on Mr. Johnson's point. Given the curious, or perhaps not so curious, lack of investigation and prosecution into Khan's network or other like-minded networks, the most significant prosecution to date, I think, having been to work in South Africa with regard to Mr. Wirch, my question is simply this. To what extent is elements of Dr. Khan's network or similar networks by, shall we say, Khan competitors or people at least emulating his legacy being utilized by the Pakistani government to get what they need outside of just a direct, you know, government offices trying to set up something directly on their own with a private source, but utilizing these illicit or clandestine channels?
I think that there have been suggestions that key figures within the Khan network are still operating, such as Peter Griffin and BSA Tahir, based in Malaysia now. I don't think there is no evidence that those people are still operating, and I think they're running scared that they haven't yet, that they have so far survived being prosecuted. I mean, there are several active prosecution cases going around against Lurk, and several people in South Africa who are still on trial, and the Tinners family in Switzerland, who I think are in custody in Germany. I think those high-profile figures are not the ones who are not under active prosecution or investigation are not active in any kind of proliferation ways at the moment. But I'm sure below the surface, much lower down, the companies. I mean, there was a report from the BND 2 years ago listing something like 200 companies which had been allied to the Pakistan procurement activities up until 2004. And a lot of those companies still operating, or they have re-emerged with different names. So I'm sure there is evidence that that some of those are actively inputting stuff to Islamabad on behalf of Pakistan authorities. Do you want to say something?
I was just going to add one other thing very quickly to that as well, which is that I think that China and North Korea have emerged as conduits, and that rather than the old configuration, we're seeing Chinese industry and North Korean companies acting to pass on that technology, and that's been reported quite widely by British and German intelligence. But the difficulty with these are suggestions at the moment, that, you know, that how do we calibrate that?
But, I mean, this all comes back down to the main problem, which is that we don't have access to any of the people who have been accused officially of proliferating from Pakistan, so that either they can speak for themselves or we can look at the evidence against them and determine that, yes, they were operating on their own, or no, they weren't. I mean, there is a complete sort of information block on that front. So I think there is a lot of kind of flying blind going on at the moment. At the back, yes.
Thank you very much. I'll make a very brief statement and a very brief question. The statement, Wendy Chamberlain from President of the Middle East Institute and former ambassador to Pakistan in 2001. My statement, because I just can't resist the fun of pretending that I was president for a day, Mr. Ziegler. And your response, if I could just carry it just one step further. I agreed with almost everything you said. I would not agree that I would cut off aid. And I would state very clearly, and I think you intimated this, that our relationship is with the Pakistani people. President Musharraf is not indispensable. Not if you have a relationship with the people, its future, and its processes. And therefore, it follows, I would not cut off aid. Because you're cutting off aid to the education, to the democracy building, capacity building, health issues. And you're also cutting off some of the, which I believe, I might take issue on this, some of the useful assistance that we give along the border. Where I would cut off aid, and I think we ought to anyway, is to these big ticket items, these big jet planes, the big defense equipment. And I would recalibrate that. Probably not reduce the aid, but shift it to strengthen the judiciary, which had started, but he stopped, unfortunately. And in strengthening the judiciary, you have to build a community police force from the ground, in the villages, in the communities, because that's where the people are not safe. We may not be safe, what we imagine is a border issue. They're not safe in their villages. Yeah. Now, So that's what I would do there. And here's my question. Very different, and it really relates to the question about India, because it is all about India if you're in Pakistan. And I was in Pakistan in December 2001 when 1 million Indian troops were amassed on the border, you know, in reaction to the bombing of the parliament. And Indian nuclear devices were moved close to the border within minutes of striking where we were, our embassy in Islamabad. And so the question is a question that's already been asked. Is the world safer with Pakistan's nuclear system? Certainly not from a non-proliferation. We can answer that. No, the world is not safer. Is Pakistan safer because Pakistan has a nuclear arsenal? Pakistan used that nuclear arsenal as a deterrent in December 2001 when threatened by a nuclear strike. It did not. President Musharraf was very clear. It would use its nuclear weapons as a response. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, to your statement as president, I'll vote for you. Definitely vote for you.
I'd like to respond to that.
Yeah, and I'll let Kathy deal with that in person. I think that's the entire thrust of where we're going. Let's separate out the Pakistan people from the Pakistan military. Yeah. I read stuff on the websites that started attacking us as anti-Pakistani. You know, our whole thrust is to understand the difference between what the Pakistan military have obtained and what the Pakistan people want from us. So I agree also about the direction of aid. In terms of your point about has it made Pakistan safer? Well, for the one occasion when that acted as a deterrent, I can think of three others where it was used in the opposite way. And I think particularly of 1990 and then again in Kargil in 1999. And if you read or talk to Carl Inderfirth or Bruce Riedel or the Talbot, wonderful Strobe Talbot book, you know, there actually was a state of mind building in the Pakistan military in 1999 that would be the method to license increasingly unacceptable aggression towards India, that kind of security umbrella to license more and more adventurous play. Of course, in the knowledge that reactions would be limited because of that. So, has it made all-out war less likely, or has it licensed more events like the bloody slog of Kargil? I mean, I think that the denuclearisation is in essence an issue. But the first thing is, of course, an understanding through with getting through the current opaqueness of what both programmes actually consist of. We don't even have the bare basics, and that I find very frightening.
No, I was just going to say that on the issue of cutting off aid, I was talking particularly about the military. I wasn't talking about humanitarian aid at all. Yes, sir. Yep. With beard. Yes, yes.
This is the last question. I just very quick points of clarification.
The F-16 sale contains no aid component. That is being built, bought entirely by Pakistan's own funds. As long as I was in government, all of the U.S. military aid was going to equipment that was in fact used in the counterinsurgency mode. In terms of strengthening the judiciary, I think they've done that quite effectively on their own. And I must say, having looked at the Pakistan judiciary very closely for 2 years, heaven help us if they stay that strong.
Can I just say on the F-16 issue, I mean, it's CSIS's own report that's being widely quoted this week that of the $10 billion that's been given to Pakistan since 9/11, $1.6 billion of that money has been spent on more F-16s. So I'm actually quoting CSIS.
You have to go back and look at the actual military aid, and at least as late as middle of 2005, there were no plans to use any of that for F-16.
Okay. We can talk after, maybe.
Yeah, I'd like to have Marvin last word, and then I'll just thank you all.
Yeah, I'm afraid I'm going to have to side with Larry on this. Now, that doesn't mean that money can't be shifted from one account to another account. I think that that's partly the answer to that. I just want to say that so much of what we're seeing here comes down to, doesn't it, the suspicion, the disappointment. These two countries do have different interests. Sometimes we forget that. We assume that because they've been in a way partners ever since the Baghdad Pact, and off and on, but nevertheless that they are naturally going to come to some sort of accommodation. Now, there are going to be many, many cases where that's not true. In the end, though, the people of Pakistan will determine their own future. And I think coming back to your question here about what's in store now, I think it's and where the U.S. fits in this. The U.S. at the moment seems to be playing a fairly active role, but I think that what it does also demonstrate is how reactive our policy is, how little it has the capacity here for preactive kind of thinking, and how much inertia there is once we have a policy position, how we find it so difficult here to transform this, to see some transition. And finally, though, in that vein, I think we have possibly crossed the Rubicon with the arrest of although I do believe she'll probably be let out very quickly. This was all tied in with her appearance at Liaquat Bagh. But it is important because so much of our policy and her policy, which sometimes is the same because she tends to think the U.S. pulls all the strings, has been based on that those two being able to work together. What this may suggest, though, is that finally that's not possible. And I think more and more people, including people in this town, are coming very, very clearly to the conclusion that Musharraf is no longer part of any solution. Mm-hmm. And that Musharraf, at this point, has become such a lightning rod himself that any stabilization of our relationship is going to be without President Musharraf.
Thank you very much, Marvin. Please join me in thanking our authors for what I think has been a stimulating